I'll be back with another full 15 minutes of all the late news at 11 o'clock. And now here is Gene Shepherd.
Shades when I do this thing, do you?
Oh, yeah.
That's tonight's mystery sound. $50,000 mystery sound. Here is the clue. It is not the top of a sugar-free Dr. Pepper being opened.
Ooh.
Here it goes again. Thank God. All right, bring it out there, please. Choo-choo. Choo-choo. Yeah, it's like that TV commercial where the guy comes on, and he says real fast. He says, among people who like instant coffee, we tested our new instant coffee against fresh pert coffee, and our coffee won. That's one of the open-ended. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? That's like saying, among people who like to eat erasers, we have tested our eraser against ham sandwiches, and our erasers won. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. To hell with it. My God, I'm not sorry. No, why did I say that? That's ridiculous. I am not sorry. And by the way, I'm not sorry I grew a mustache. Although I must say it's getting to be unbelievably controversial. I'm starting to get these angry letters from people who say, either shave up that mustache or I won't never listen to you again. You know, that kind of stuff. One letter I got the other day said, dear Mr. Shepherd, I was disappointed and shocked to find when I saw you on television the other night that you have a mustache. I just believe that everywhere I go, the hippie atmosphere, the drug scene is getting... You know? And I said, well, you know, after all the great Old Testament prophets had at least mustaches. Some of the Old Testament prophets were made entirely of hair. great mounds of hair with feet sticking out of the bottom. And it is true that the mustache is highly controversial. If my father, who is long since deceased, were to ever see this mustache, if he ever saw it, he'd flip. Because one of his favorite words of advice was never trust a guy with a mustache and a bow tie. He says, you be careful, and if you run into a guy that's got both of those, like a mustache and a bow tie, never, never have nothing to do with that guy. He's going to peel you like a grape. And, maybe he was right, you know. So I would suggest be careful. But this is quite a startling mustache, isn't it? You agree with it, Bill? It makes a very definite statement. It's somewhat satanic, but nevertheless, it makes a genuine statement. And I would like to say this, that the male has been 50-50. Some would say, oh, wow, groovy, fantastic. I thought groovy was an expression that was long since, gone out, like hot diggity dog, but it keeps coming in. You want it to curl? I see. You want it to curl up like this? Oh, I can do that. But for those of you, I'd like to know, because I'm going to make a great decision here in my life. It's a great decision. Anyone who's ever shaved off a mustache or a beard knows that it's not a thing you do lightly. It's a major decision. And I would like to know right now where we stand here. Not that it will make one whit of difference, because where is it? I mean, where is it today? I'd like to put, after all, this is a democratic country, right? And the people have a right to know. And where do we stand? How do you, Jerry? Do you like my mustache? Yeah, you better. How about you? You're less with it, huh? You don't know. You'll admit it's changed my outward appearance drastically. That's right. I look like a guy you should not play a hand of poker with. Not quite, huh? Well, my feeling is that it'll settle down when all the dust settles. And the only problem with mustaches, generally, and beards, when they get full, is the old problem of beard weevil. For any of you who've ever had a case of beard weevils, you know exactly what I mean. Bill, you probably never had a beard, have you? You haven't. Well, if you've ever had a beard, if you're fortunate, you haven't had the beard weevil problem. But the beard weevil is a problem. It's beard weevil and beard roaches, two different things. And have you noticed guys with beards doing like this? Okay, a guy that is doing like that has either beard roaches or beard weevils, and it comes from endless doses of caked Campbell's tomato soup in the beard. And eventually, your beard, little nests of beard roaches and beard weevils take hold. And, after that, it's problems. The only thing you can do is ultimately shave it off and get defumigated and all that stuff and start over again. But the beard roach is a problem. I have not yet had this problem with the mustache because I've been very careful. You remember when they called mustaches cookie dusters? You ever hear that expression? Well, see, you just come from a very, very, very respectable background, Bill. You haven't heard of much anyway. I've noticed that. The other day, I asked Bill if he heard of Italy. And he says, oh, yeah, that's that kind of food they make down there. I see it on a sign. No, that's a country, Bill. The food came afterwards. And, ignorance. I'm not putting anybody down for ignorance. I have a great dollop of it myself. Although I attempt to hide it at times, other people flaunt it. And then put it into a credo. And ultimately have it hemstitched on pillows. But I don't want none of them cheese things. But, we're getting far afield here. I meant to... by the way, speaking of putting it into a credo, I take great pleasure tonight in reporting to you out there that at last our artistic... urges in our time are beginning to take a realistic twist. For a while, art generally, and people art generally, was quite romantic. And I'm a student of a certain type of art which is not often talked about. For example, I'm a student of aquarium architecture. Aquariums, you know, what is it? Do I have to explain to you what an aquarium is? But you understand what that is. That's that, you know, that glass thing with the fish in it. You've seen that. Water, all that. Yeah. All right, that's an aquarium. Well, aquarium architecture is how the aquarium or aquaria is landscaped and decorated. Now, you've seen for a long time the bottoms of aquariums or aquaria tended to run to little medieval castles. On the bottom, you see the little castle on the bottom there? Well, this was a highly romantic concept of an aquarium. And it was the Rococo period of aquarium architecture was when the little statues... Once in a while, you could get a little mermaid on the bottom. You've seen those little mermaids they put on the bottom of that. Occasionally, a little pirate ship down there. You've seen that. That was a more daring aquarium. But most recently, and I'm delighted to report that the art of aquarium decorating has taken a fantastically realistic turn. Really, a great turn. Excuse me, not turn, turn. And I saw it just inadvertently. I was visiting a friend, not really a friend. This guy chews tobacco and walks around, belches a lot. And, just a despicable character in most ways, but nevertheless, one who has a certain flair for being attached to and absorbing the current now, which is another way of saying the guy's somewhat with it. So, nevertheless, I'm visiting this guy's house. See, so we're sitting there, we're eating pepperoni heroes, and I'm looking over the rubble of his house, which is the thousands of old beer cans and all that junk in the house. And so I see, though, his one great pride and joy is his aquarium. Guy's a fish cuckoo, and it's a beautiful aquarium. It's one of these great big 50-gallon tankers, you know, great big square one, beautiful aquarium, and all lit up. And it's the only thing in his house that he keeps clean. I mean, it's really clean, and it's beautiful. You know, it's all green, and it's lit up, and he's got all these fish in there, neon tetras and stuff swimming around. And I go over and look at the aquarium. It looked a little different. I says, "Hey, Clarence, this is fantastic, this aquarium." He said, "Yes, you've been working on it." And the bottom of the aquarium, you know, the bottom where the bottom is, and you remember how they used to have colored pebbles, like little green, blue pebbles and little fairy tale castles in the bottom? The new aquarium trend is to have a real bottom just the way you would find it today. And so you can get little rotting tires, and you can get little beer cans, little tiny miniature rusting beer cans all over the bottom of the aquarium. That's a fact. I'm not kidding you. And all the clutter, rusting car bodies. There were car bodies and rust and crud on the bottom there. And you can even get imitation. It's really pure. It's not deleterious to the life of the fish. It's fake sediment. You can get the fake crud that looks like it's drifted out of the sewage system of some nearby city. And so there it is. And it's really, really pretty spectacular. You know, there's a little, it's all done with various bits of vinyl and stuff. And there's old newspapers down there on the bottom. And they look like they're rotted. And it's a very realistic bottom of a fish tank. And very good. In fact, he says that that some of his friends are working on various types of landscapes that you can reproduce, for example, the landscape of the bottom of the Harlem River, which would be exciting. The landscape of the East River down in the lower teens. And, you know, that would really be exciting. Old rusting bicycles and junk. And amid all of it there, you can see a form half buried in the silt wearing a concrete overcoat. the kind of stuff you'd really find in the bottom. So I looked at this and I said, you know, that's a whole new trend in what has heretofore been a sickeningly saccharine romantic scene, you know, the fairy tale castles in the bottom now. And I says, how far does this go? He says, oh, well, you can do pretty much anything you want. I said, what do you mean, anything you want? He says, oh, yeah. He says, you can do anything you want. He says, you know, now in the very hip aquarium landscape places, you can get tiny little wee bitty miniatures. Of course, that's redundant, but you can get little itsy bitsy miniatures of almost anything that would be found in the ordinary river or lake bottom of today. And I said, anything? He says, yes, anything. He says, of course, you can't have some of these aquariums. You don't want to have kids around, you know, because of the nature of some of the stuff you find in the bottom of the river there. He said, but you can have an adult aquarium that's rated X. I just thought you ought to know that things are progressing well. I kind of like that trend. Well, it's commercial time, and let's see. Oh, Castro. Yes, indeed. Some people spend their whole lives on a Castro. Castro's spectacular year-end clearance sale. They're having a discontinued one-of-a-kind convertible sofas, love seats, sectionals, tables, chairs, even some high-fashion accessories, with savings up to 40%. It takes a lot to be number one, and Castro manufactures its own 6 plants, sells direct to you in its own 70 showrooms, and then delivers free. Anyway, they're having a big sale at Castro, a year-end clearance sale, so get on a shtick. Get down there. Are you ready to hear that little Castro jingle? Hit it, George.
Who was the first to conquer space? It's incomparable.
Castro convertible.
Castro
convertible.
Yeah. You know, another thing, too. One of the parts of the other, maybe it's part of the same trend, but you can also buy the same kind of things that are in the river, that live in the river, to swim around in it. In short, instead of having the usual goldfish or fantail, you know, the usual walking around dumb-looking fish, which reminds me, this is WOR in New York, instead of the usual dumb-looking fish, you can get the kind of fishes that really live in the river. For example, you can buy miniature carp now, a real carp. I'm not talking about, of course, the goldfish is part of the carp family anyway, but I'm talking about a carp, the kind that lives at the bottom of the Schuylkill River or the bottom of the East River, you know, and walks around and eats garbage. That's what a carp is like. You can buy bullheads, a real bullhead, and you put it down. And so you could people your aquarium with the kind of stuff you'd see. Like, for example, you can get little green eels and bullheads, carps, toads. You can get a toad put in there and have a genuine proletarian aquarium. You know, that's that consists of what used to be called trash fish. And now they're down there. It's just like, there's another trend, you know. There's a trend that's going on out in the suburbs, which is kind of a rejection of the old values. See, I think this is good. I think for years people have had set the kind of values. People, for example, there were things called flowers, right? Flowers and weeds. Well, the flower was desirable, and the weed was something to be fought, correct? But that was all a matter of viewpoint. I mean, all a matter of how the eye sees things. Who's to say that, let's say, that an orchid is any prettier than a dandelion? I mean, who's going to make that judgment? Well, we did. And I'm glad to see that a lot of this is going by the boards. In fact, a lot of people I know out in the suburbs are now preparing. This is all part of the new attitude towards things. They're preparing actual lawns made entirely of beautifully nurtured crabgrass. And they'll be proud of it. I mean, he's raising vintage crabgrass, is one friend of mine. He's in fact sending all over the country for various hardy strains and beautiful strains of crabgrass, which he is planting in his yard in Darien. He's getting rid of all that, you know, that old stuff, that bluegrass and that Bermuda green and all that. And he's going in for the real stuff. You can, for example, I know one guy in Flemington, New Jersey, who recently acquired a packet of seeds, not easy to get, of a virulent form of poison ivy. And he's going to grow poison ivy in his backyard as an active thing, not a thing to be fought against, but an active thing. Poison ivy, liverwort, crab grass. You can put a few scorpions in your yard and have an exciting yard. It's a little more exciting than the usual green. You know that one guy, by the way, gave up the whole damn thing and had his entire yard paved and painted green over in Jersey. He's got flower beds painted on it, too. And he can just change the flower. These are actually decals, the flower beds. You can have them change whenever you want. And that way you can also use your yard for playing stickball and various other things. And you certainly don't have to mow the concrete. So we're moving in very interesting directions. Do you agree, Bill? It's kind of silly, I mean. But, I don't put anything down about that. I just think it's fine. I have nothing against concrete. I have nothing against crabgrass. But then again, on the other hand, I have nothing for carnations, chrysanthemums, and the various other things that people seem to have a hang-up on, right? I mean, why should you have to limit yourself to have a dog for a pet or a cat? You know, why not a crocodile or a hooded cobra? Why not? I mean, just because they've been put down for so many years. And, the world is changing, and I think for the good. In fact, I saw one of the great toys that I've seen recently is a beautiful wind-up thing. You can get it at FAO Schwartz. It actually is not wind-up. It's run with a battery, one of these little 9-volt batteries. Kind of nice. It's a little bathtub shark, and it goes like hell. I mean, it'll attack you. You drop that in the swimming pool, and you get a little excitement there on it. On a Wednesday night, that little shark moves around. It has a sensor device in the nose that goes right at you. Man, it detects warm bodies in the water and goes. And then it's a proximity fuse is what it is, basically. You can also get yourself a little battery-operated torpedo-expelling submarine. Shoots a torpedo. Explodes with a loud wham when it hits the ribs of your friend. And but you think I'm being funny, but it's all part of the new cult of devil worship. These are all products of the devil, no question about it. For those of you who are interested, a couple of days ago we talked about the devil briefly, and a woman wrote me the other day, and she said, I'm quoting, she said, "Hey, Shepherd, I cannot see how you have allowed your mind, which is obviously a fairly adequate mind, to take up such an obscene instrument as the Jew's harp. This instrument should be relegated to the very depths of hell from which it came." Never occurred to me that the Jew's harp is an instrument of hell. And the violin, of course, is an instrument of the heavenly angels. I don't know, you know? It's a good sound. I like that sound. Bill, would you give me something to play with there? Let's hear it. The hell with you, lady. I mean, what the devil are you laying on? Very nice. That's good, yeah. I don't know what compelled me to do that, but, yeah, you know, what the hell. Did you enjoy that? Mm-hmm. I don't know why. But then one should not look aesthetics and beauty too close, right? Shouldn't examine it too closely, because then you destroy the fragile flower of gratification. You know, it's like wondering why the hell you're doing it when you're doing it, which you should never do, really. No way. Well, now, actually, though, since the realism of our time is slowly beginning to... On the one hand, we're getting more realistic. On the other hand, we're getting far more sentimental, both at the same time. It's hard to believe. But here's a guy who wrote me a note. He says, recently... Yeah, this is right in keeping with it, see? He says, Shepard, he said, I heard you mention on a recent broadcast that you used to race cockroaches. Yes, indeed. In fact, I still occasionally do race the cockroaches to what I'm eating. I've fought many a cockroach over a pastrami sandwich. Some of them even brought their relatives. But he says, small time, that's true. And he makes a point. See, if for those of you who might have missed the cockroach show, and I'm one of the great chroniclers of the cockroach, and I was doing cockroach stories long before it became popular. Everybody's writing about them and all. And but I, as long ago as 8, 9, 10 years ago, I was advocating the cockroach as the one creature that will probably inherit the earth. You've heard the biblical enjoinder, the biblical statement that the meek shall inherit the earth. They don't say people. At no point did they refer to the meek being people. No way. There's no such thing as a meek person. That's almost a contradiction in terms. I mean, by the standards of the entire catalog of creations. If you do believe in a supreme deity, you do. I mean, I don't know whether you do or not. But if you do, let's accept that premise, if you do. You have to accept other premises, too. Not only did God then, if you do believe in a God, create man, he also created the snail. Now, the snail did not come full-blown, equipped with all that gooey stuff and everything, without having been created by something. If you accept the premise that man was created by God, you must accept the premise that something else created all the other things, right? Okay, well, in that case, then, God must have created also the cockroach. Now, as it has been said many times, God's ways are mysterious and often totally enigmatic to man. Why God created the cockroach will remain a mystery. But then I'm sure to cockroaches why God created man is a fantastic mystery too. Because by cockroach standards, we are monsters. I mean, we run around and squirt them with stuff and step on them and stomp them. And I have not yet been squirted by anything by a cockroach. And I certainly haven't been stomped by one in a long time. Although several have tried it. I mean, the larger ones, but they don't pull it off. They tend to just quietly hide under the daybed and wait their chance, right? Now, that is really the true definition of the meek. And they're not aggressive. They're just persistent. That's all. So there is a certain and growing body of opinion that the cockroach will... You heard it here first. I think I started that whole belief. In fact, I know I did, but I think the cockroach will eventually take over the earth. Now, the cockroach is a sporting creature, has been investigated by many people. We used to race them, Bill, when I was a kid. You know how you race cockroaches? Well, you catch a cockroach first, right, and you put them in a matchbox. Now you've got your stable, or at least you've got the beginnings of your stable, because most of the really good cockroach races would have four or five in their stable. And because, it's just like anything else. Not all cockroaches are created equal, any more than all men are created equal. In short, let's face it. Let's face one important thing, and it is this, roughly. Wilt Chamberlain plays basketball better than you. So in the basketball playing scene, you are not equal to Mr. Chamberlain, right? Okay. Now, you have to accept that that's the way cockroaches are. Some can run faster than others. And if you tend to think that all cockroaches are them bugs, referred to callously by people who do not know the subtle differences. How many times have I heard people say, the trouble with cockroaches, they all look alike. I can't tell one from the other. I've heard people say that. It's a tragic mistake and terribly demeaning to a cockroach. There are vast differences between cockroaches, and particularly in the speed angle. And you find this out if you start racing cockroaches. To the ordinary walking around klutz, all horses look alike. Ho, ho, ho. If you ever put $2 on one going at Roosevelt, you will find that they are not all alike. And it could be very perverse. In fact, the worst-looking horse often runs faster than the best-looking horse. Is that true, Jerry? Yeah, and that's how many guys got euchred. They walk them around before the race, and this great, fantastic-looking horse with golden tassels all over it, yeah, picks his feet up, boy, and he snorts. And what happens when the gate, when the bell rings? Nothing. That's right. That little short, fat one over there with the patch over one eye, what happened? Zowie. Nothing but a cloud of dust. And he paid $17.50. Well, all right. So this is the problem that you find with the cockroach. And we used to raise them. See, and I don't want to belabor the point, but I just wanted to explain what this guy's talking about in his letter. And how you race a cockroach, you make a circle. You make a big circle, about a 10-foot circle. An absolute pure circle. And you do that by taking a 5-foot piece of string and taking chalk on the end of it and holding it down on the other end. You run around, you make a circle. You got a good 10-foot circle, right? And then you make a dot in its center where it is. And then on a given signal, you holler. Everybody drops his cockroach, opens his little box all at the same time and drops them in the center of the circle. And then you jump back. And the cockroach that makes it to the line first wins. Now, certain cockroaches have to be motivated. They'll just stand and look, with their feelers going. Other cockroaches get the idea fast. You drop them, they're off like a shot. You're liable to lose your best stable, your best stable entry down some drain so fast, you wouldn't believe it. And we used to color them. You take Crayola crayon, and you color your cockroach. Everybody had his own colors. Some guys had purple with red spots. Other guys had the green. You actually have your own racing colors. And you decorate your matchbox in the same colors. Your total stable. And we used to buy and sell cockroaches. A guy has a really great breeding cockroach. It's not necessarily a good running cockroach. A guy has a good breeder. Stud mare, a stud or a mare, and he trade them off. And so it's quite a complex thing. But this guy wrote me this letter here, and he says, I heard you talk about your great cockroach racing experience. It's a shepherd, small time. I want you to listen carefully to this letter. It says, when I was at college in Florida, we used to race burning palmetto bugs in the dormitories. He says, keep in mind that your average Florida palmetto bug, you've heard of a palmetto bug? Well, a palmetto bug It's really a euphemism. It's, down south, as it is true of the north, people don't want to concede much. And so if you have a 6-pound cockroach, that sounds terrible, The cockroach runs across your floor, and you can hear the floor creaking when he runs, and you can hear the thumping of his feet. And he crashes through the screen door. Well, you don't want to admit you got a 12-pound cockroach. So they say, oh, look, the palmetto bug. Well, they call them palmetto bugs, and that's just another name for a giant cockroach, and they do have them down there. They're fantastic. About the size of a mouse. Oh, they're enormous. And he says, ooh, they move. You wouldn't believe how fast they are. And he is being very, very conservative when he says that your average Florida palmetto bug is at least 3 times the size of the typical puny cockroach of the north. Now, our cockroaches are called German cockroaches. These are German cockroaches that we have in this area, generally. And he says, keep in mind, I'd say they're more like 10 times the size of an ordinary cockroach. Now, here's how they would race them. He says, once we captured our palmetto bugs, which isn't easy, we would turn out the lights and squirt lighter fluid on them. We would then throw a lit match on each bug and let them go streaking across the floor in the form of a blazing fireball. Now, wait a minute. I'm not laughing because I'm sadistic. I'm laughing at the strange twist that the human mind takes. Now, you can understand why we are not the meek. Not many cockroaches squirt lighting fluid on you and watch you go running across the floor a fireball, right? Leave it to man. He says, unfortunately, the winner of the race met with the same fiery end as the losers. Now, here is where his point gets interesting. He says, lest you think the foregoing a barbaric practice, let me remind you that it merely reflects an earlier cruel youth which we all shared. The myth that little kids are warm and tender has constantly been perpetuated by TV shows such as Lassie and in such books by Dr. Spock. That is true. Nothing can be further from the truth. I agree with that. Oh, cruelty knows no bounds in a kid. He says, think of how many times you've seen kids torturing their pet hamsters, or the look of glee on their faces as they frantically dissect the frog in science class. True. He says, I can remember the times that my mother used to drag me to the supermarket when I was a kid. Having nothing better to do, I would wander over to the front window, which in the windows of all supermarkets was covered with buzzing flies trying to get out. I would then proceed to grab the flies, yank off their wings, and left them to scurry about the floor. Now, that's true. That is absolutely true. And not many adults do that kind of thing. He said, there was this kid that lived around the corner from me who we used to call the monk. He carried this procedure a bit further. He would take the de-winged flies home with him and chop off their heads in a homemade guillotine. The guillotine was made out of a matchbox, rubber bands, toothpicks, and a razor blade. The craftsmanship that went into its construction was worthy of the best of the Swiss watchmakers. The monk would carefully place a fly on the edge of the matchbox, pull back the toothpick, which was attached to the razor blade, and let the rubber band spring the blade down upon the fly, thus neatly chopping its head off. He would then place the fly head into a matchbox and repeat the process until he had dozens of matchboxes filled with fly heads. Now, these fly heads were left to age in the matchboxes for several weeks. Most of them would become dry and discolored. However, every once in a while, through a rare combination of a neat cut, aging, and oxidation, a perfectly formed, pure, white fly head would develop. These pure white fly heads were extremely rare. It was, however, their very rarity, in addition to their dazzling beauty, which made them so valuable. Just as only a minuscule amount of coal will eventually yield diamonds, so too will only a very few freshly cut fly heads ultimately form into a pure white fly head, maybe one out of 200 at best. Kids from all over the neighborhood came to see the monk's collection of pure white fly heads, which after a few months numbered several dozen. Soon all the guys wanted a pure white fly head collection of their own. It was not long before everybody built their own guillotine kit by which they would deliver the coup de grace upon the unfortunate flies. My own bedroom was the scene of much bloody guillotine. It must have resembled Paris at the height of the French Revolution. I could almost hear the rumble of the drums as I pulled back the blade, followed by a roar from the mob as I let the blade snap down upon the nervous little fly. Unfortunately, I personally was never able to produce a pure white fly head. The fly heads would crumble or become spotty after a few weeks. A few turned to a grayish white. But for some reason, I was never blessed with a pure white fly head. In fact, nobody in the neighborhood was able to yield the desired fly head. Only the monk, like a winemaker producing a perfect vintage, was able to create the elusive pure white fly head. The whole fly head affair became an obsession with me. I wasn't able to eat or sleep well. I was constantly breaking out into cold sweats. The only thing I knew was that I had to have a pure white fly head of my own. Finally, one day, I could stand it no longer. I walked over to the monk's place and saw him outside throwing darts at a frog. Hey, monk, I said, how about it if I let you take a look at some of your... How about it if I took a look at some of your comic books? The monk had an enormous collection of comic books that went back maybe three or four centuries. Okay, but don't fold the pages back, said the monk, not looking up as he stared at the frog hopping around with darts stuck all over it. I went into his bedroom, and behind the stacks of comic books on top of a small table, I spotted what I was looking for. The matchboxes with the pure white fly head. Cold sweat came streaming down my forehead as I opened one of the matchboxes. I stood there gazing at the fly heads with all their pearl-like beauty. Quickly, I jammed one of the boxes into my shirt pocket and dashed home. Once home, I locked myself in my bedroom and placed the fly heads carefully on the floor. For about an hour, I lay there in front of the fly heads, just staring at them with reverence. Finally, the scene of blissfulness was broken by an angry shout outside my window. Give me back my fly heads! It was the monk. I don't have no fly heads, I replied. And even if I do, I only want to borrow them for a while. I want them now, the monk screamed. Otherwise, you're going to have to pay me for them. They're mine! This was followed by a round of negotiations between us of such intensity as to put Harry Kissinger and Lee Doc Toad to shame. We were getting nowhere in our arguments when all of a sudden we heard a creeping, cheeping sound. walking across the lawn was my pet baby chicken. The monk ran over and grabbed the chick. If you don't bring me my four heads within a half an hour, you won't see a chicken alive again, he gloatingly yelled as he ran home. I was in a moral dilemma. My chicken was being held hostage. I needed to have those fly heads, but I was also strongly attached to my pet chicken. I already had the chicken for a whole 3 weeks, which is pretty unusual when you consider that the average lifespan of a baby chicken when owned by a 9-year-old kid is usually never more than 1 week, more on the order of hours. Finally, after wrestling with my conscience for a while, I grabbed a box of fly heads and went running down the street to the monk's place. As I rounded the corner, I spotted the monk in his yard. I held a large rock over his head with both hands. He held a large rock over his head with both hands. At his feet was my chicken. He resembled King Kong about to toss a large boulder on a subway. No, monk, no! I yelled in desperation. Whomp! Too late. The monk disappeared into his house as I came running up to the chicken-smeared rock. I flipped the rock over, but there was nothing I could do. The only first aid I knew was artificial respiration, but it didn't seem appropriate to a chicken. I sat there for a while in silent memory of the dead chicken and the 49 cents I had paid for it. And from within the monk's house, I could hear an evil laugh. As I mentioned before, Shepherd, youth is cruel. A former flyhead freak. All right. Now, there you are. Now, I would like to... Now, don't laugh. No, I'm serious. Don't laugh. That is one of the great myths of our time. That man is born a beautiful, tender creature, and that he cannot harm anything. And it's only later that evil society creates him into this monster. Whereas actually, the truth is probably quite the opposite. It's only society that keeps us from going around pulling people's heads off. You know? And how this myth got started, I don't know. Maybe this myth got started because little tiny babies are incapable, due to the fact that their muscles aren't developed yet enough, to decapitate you. You know, they can only lay there and, you know, you got to keep pouring pablum down them. That's about all I have. But give him that. 5 minutes after he's walking around, what's he doing? He's got a dog by the ear and is slamming it up against the front of the car, right? And now his true vocation has come. It's only when there is, you know, society in the form of you and other people come rushing up. Hey, you're killing Towser! Society prevents him from doing Towser in. And that is the only reason Towser's alive and walking around and still eating Alpo. So I don't know how that myth got started. Did I ever tell you about the fantastic thing? You know, this sweeps through crowds of kids like some kind of a peculiar plague, and then it disappears. Disappears. Did I tell you about the time that we went into the white mice thing? All of a sudden, it was a very big thing in the neighborhood, you know, neighborhood to have white mice, right? So one of the kids took his white mouse one day, and he discovered that you could get dye down at the dime store for 10 cents a package. You know, dye, the kind of you dye your curtains with. And he dipped his white mouse into bright orange dye, at which point he had an orange white mouse. Well, now, you know, that didn't do the mouse any good. I mean, that mouse was orange. Well, instantly, everybody ran around and dipped their white mice into various colored dye. Now you got green, blue, purple, yellow, orange, pearlescent. You have various colors of white mice. Well, that was okay for a while. The next thing that was tried was a little more basic and biological, which we will not go into because there are kids listening and might give them some idea. But suffice it to say that the ingenuity of kids in the area of deforming the fellow creatures that walk the earth with us knows no bounds. The idea of constructing a little tiny matchbox guillotine to whack off the tops of heads would only occur to a kid. Particularly demonic view of life. But, then there was a time. Nah, there's no point in going into it, but at this hour. But there are all kinds of forms of evil. It isn't sadism, though, at that point. You agree? Did I ever tell you about the time that we found this this transformer, we had a power transformer that we'd taken out of an old radio, had about 700 volts on it. And we put some condensers in it, you know, in the output, and we put some big leads on these condensers, and we chased cockroaches around. And you'd apply both leads to a cockroach, and I want to tell you, if you think sparklers is exciting, you ought to see an exploding cockroach with about 700 volts going through them. Pow! You know? Woo! Cheer! Woo! Oh, man, I'll tell you, deep within the heart of every creature, there lies a ravening monster with purple fangs and glowing red eyes. Which reminds me, this is WOR New York. You stay tuned for Lester Smith and the news.